The next case is 96-2384, Ron Scheider and Associates versus City of London, Ohio. Mr. Collins.
Good morning, Mansion Support. I'm Kevin Collins. I'm here on behalf of Dan and Alicia. This is a little bit unusual because Alicia was not a party to the trial for the case alone. It was the attorney for the plaintiffs. It's also a little bit unusual in that Mr. Shipper was not at all involved in the initiation of the plaintiff's case in the trial court. What I'm here about today, of course, is the imposition of sanctions arising from the attorney fees from the prosecution of a motion for sanctions. And in preparing today, I went through to get some idea of how much of the approximately $45,000 in sanctions we're dealing with. And although it isn't perfectly clear either from decisions below or from the we're talking about over $10,000. And our position is really very simple. There are three reasons that these particular sanctions we're talking about today shouldn't be applied to counsel for plaintiffs. The first would be rules of construction. The second would be the fairly straightforward wording of the statute, and third, and perhaps most important is the balancing of policies. And that's what I really would like to focus on. There is a balancing that has to be done to say that an attorney who's violating Rule 11, which is not that issue here. This is under 2223.1, and the difference between the subjective bad faith standard and the objective reasonable attorney standard is important. Let's say that an attorney willfully violates the rule is really incorrect. We're talking about what is reasonable and what is reasonable in a practical day-to-day sense, and there will be a trade-off. There necessarily, logically, will be a trade-off. And it is the same trade-off that will operate as to the application of both the statute for frivolous conduct in the case in chief. Where you're talking about the sanctions motion, it's carrying it one step farther. And the trade-off is between deterring frivolous conduct and showing the appropriate and legitimate advocacy on the part of your client.
Counsel, let's take a hypothetical and say that the evidence clearly establishes and there's really not very much excuse that there was frivolous conduct. And the opposing party brings a motion for frivolous conduct under statute. The trial takes 5 days. The motion itself, the hearing and all the evidence on the motion takes 3 days. So that party that's been aggrieved now by the frivolous conduct has incurred the 5-day trial and now incurs the additional 3 days of attorney fees to prosecute the motion. You're proposing that they only recover the frivolous conduct for the trial, but not for the 3 days of the hearing itself. That's your position, correct?
That is correct. I would add to that it is conceivable that the conduct would be so clearly frivolous that opposing the motion may itself be frivolous. For that, it should not be a continuation.
But if the goal of the statute is to make somebody whole who has been subject to a frivolous conduct action, they are hardly left whole when they still have a whole bunch of attorney fees they've incurred just to prosecute the motion. I mean, that seems to me, if an attorney engages in conduct with his client that is frivolous, an attorney ought to know you know, looking at the fact and evidence, whether it is or not, it turned out to be just as subject as a crime to a person's testimony.
No, I want to point out two things in response to that, that there are many decisions that the attorney cannot make. Attorney enforcement advised the client, but ultimately, a lot of safety for the clients.
But does not the trial judge have discretion to assess some of the fees to the client and some of the fees to the attorney?
Oh, certainly.
So the judge can look at the fact and say, this is what the client did, and this is what the attorney did, and the client's going to pay X, and the attorney's going to pay Y. And I did that as a trial judge many times.
And in fact, that's what happened in this case. There were specific findings on what conduct was frivolous. And the only conduct of attorney Shiflett that was raising this civil conspiracy claim, not the initiation, not the going to trial, simply the raising of a civil conspiracy claim, which, by the way, never, the complaint was never amended, and it was not raised in any kind of formal way.
And is that then a factual determination by the trial judge that you're asking us to just second guess or review?
No, Your Honor, I really don't think so. What is at stake here is more than just compensation of the aggrieved parties. That is certainly one of the policies behind this statute, but it is not the overriding policy. The overriding policy, I would submit, is deterring frivolous conduct, not compensation. Compensation, that goes back to the American rule on attorney fees. And because this is a derogation of that rule, it is to be strictly construed.
Are you asking us for a rule that an attorney can never be liable for the fees on a civil conduct motion?
I don't think that is what we're asking for.
What rule would you have us craft?
The words of the statute, whether you're talking about the statute as it existed at the time of this case or as it exists now, the words of the statute require necessitation by the frivolous conduct. And that is a strict causal relationship. Necessity. If opposing the motion is itself frivolous, or if prosecuting the motion is itself frivolous, I would agree wholeheartedly that then sanctions of some sort are appropriate.
And then aren't you back to saying the judge has discretion to make that call?
The judge has to exercise discretion within the boundary set by the statute.
And isn't that what this judge did?
That is not what this judge did. What happened is that this judge carried out to the logical extreme, avoiding the maximum possible sanctions under the statute for the maximum possible conduct under the statute. And although technically, I mean, you're talking about the conflict between the courts of appeals decision, factually, I would submit, no, that is not supported by findings or by the evidence that came before this court. There's much more to it than simply compensating the aggrieved party, and as I mentioned, that is not, I would submit, that is not the overriding purpose of the statute. Judicial economy is another factor that must be considered. This is an issue of managing the civil justice system. What happens is a logical necessity where this is carried out to the extreme, as it has been in this case. There will be more motions for frivolous conduct. There will be more hearings on motions for frivolous conduct. Now, the so-called satellite litigation, that a number of the federal courts have noticed, has become a problem. In addition to the whole issue of chilling legitimate advocacy, and what happens by extending these rules is it puts an attorney in a position where you have some very difficult, perhaps impossible choices between figuring out what your duties are for the canons of ethics, figuring out what you can do without incurring a very large sanction.
Well, but the question is just that. Was this legitimate advocacy, legal advocacy? You know, there's some people's reputations who have been badly damaged. Maybe part of the sanction theory is punishment.
Deterrence and punishment go hand in hand, Your Honor. I do not dispute that.
Well, the judicial economy, you know, we hear that all the time, but how else could some of these people who had to go through this for this lengthy period of time, in effect, get their day in court, too?
They have their day in court, they have their opportunity, and did avail themselves of the opportunity to go to the media. This is a problem with any litigation, whether it's criminal.
Well, that's a great way to solve the problem. I recognize that's being done in a number of cases. You go to the media and take care of it, but the issue is, shouldn't it be settled in the court? And after it is settled in the court and you're vindicated, shouldn't you have some rights? Where it's clearly frivolous.
As to what happens in court, as to what happens in the course of the litigation, most certainly. When we're talking about the prosecution of the motion for sanctions, that is a step removed. Yeah, there is some possible chain there, but it does not fit within the necessity probable requirement, unless opposing or prosecuting that motion is itself frivolous. And in this case, there are quite a few issues that just simply were not that clear, and frankly aren't that clear now. There's a lot of different interpretations and applications throughout the state, and it's a very difficult position. As my learned colleague before me mentioned, in the trenches, these things aren't all that clear.
Isn't that why we leave it to the trial court? There's considerable discretion here, isn't there? Under statute? The statute gives considerable discretion, does it not?
The statute does give discretion, and it gives direction to exercise the discretion. And by saying sanctions may include attorney fees necessitated by the frivolous conduct, that is a very direct instruction to exercise that discretion, and so why is this strict causal connection? If it isn't there, then there should be no sanctions.
Counsel, we do clarify something in my mind. I'm a little confused by your argument. Where did your client, where did he, how did he participate?
Your Honor, Mr. Shiflett,
where did he come in this act?
He was, perhaps to be a better way, but was a friend of Mr. Scheider. Mr. Scheider ran a private investment.
Was he involved in
the business contract?
Was he involved in the original action?
Absolutely not.
Right, so
not the least bit involved
the initial action, that is the subject matter of the frivolous conduct. Or is it bringing the frivolous conduct charge, the thing that we have a problem with. You seem to indicate that he came in and defended a client for a charge of frivolous conduct, or bringing a frivolous conduct suit.
No, that's not correct either. Mr. Shiflett did not draft the complaint, he did not initiate the litigation. He came in approximately, I think, 8 months prior to the trial.
Trial of what?
The trial of the plaintiff's complaint.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that answers what you're asking me or not.
Well, I'm a little confused as to the activity of your client. You seem to come up and say he wasn't involved in this, he wasn't involved in this, he was only involved in something, and I can't quite figure out what he was involved in.
He was involved in handling the litigation after January of 94. The case was filed in September of 93, if I remember correctly. I don't have a record from me. And then September of 94 was the trial. So from January to September, when the plaintiff realized he was going to have to try his case, he better get an attorney.
Okay.
By that point,
he came in.
Well, what do you mean when he realized he was going to have to try his case? He thought he'd file a lawsuit and was going to try itself?
I'm not sure what he thought. And that was perhaps outlined when he assumed that he thought that. I don't know what would they use the driver that was talking to Mr. Zipper about representing him. I do know, however, that there was no participation, Mr. Schiffer, in advising Mr. Schneider, bringing dates, and formulating the cause of action, in determining who the defendants were, and that's part of...
Okay, but at some point in January, presumably before that, the client brings the file to the attorney and says, this is what I filed on my own, will you help? If you buy into that, then aren't you in all the way? You've either got to get an amended complaint going if you think it's not properly styled, it isn't the proper cause of action, those kind of things, or it becomes your handiwork.
To some degree, that's probably correct. I don't think
well, that... Well, I mean, how can you come in as counsel and not, at that point, assume responsibility for what's filed? You certainly have an opportunity to amend the filings.
There are two things I'd like to respond to that, if I may.
You may.
The first is that a lot of the decisions are not the attorneys to make. You are given what has happened at that point.
Well, then you don't have to come in. If the client's saying, no, you can't amend this, if the attorney looks at it and says, I think this is spurious, we've got to change all this around. The client says, no, you got a real easy call. Find another lawyer. I mean, right at the front end of the thing.
In hindsight, that is a pretty easy answer, and I would just submit that.
Well, I mean, isn't that one of the problems with the profession, that not too many lawyers don't exercise that kind of judgment right up front with the client?
The problem really boils down to somebody comes in and says, I've been wrong, this is what's happened. And as an attorney, you are to find a way to...
As an attorney, sometimes you're supposed to say life is hard, and there is no known method of recovery for whatever it is that you think you've been wronged about.
The counseling effect, we counsel that you have no remedy. That is a legitimate role of a lawyer, isn't it?
That is one legitimate role of a lawyer.
But you did not seem to acknowledge that your first answer. Just frankly, you said your job is to find something to do for this person.
If they have been wrong, if there is some available way to redress.
Some available, permissible under the law, right? That's our job.
That is part of the job, certainly.
But our job is not to make up something and please a client.
No, the second one I wanted to bring up is that, yeah, there is admittedly some responsibility there, but say it's the same responsibility as when you name the defendant, you draft the claims and develop the formulate them, and see from that, say that that's the same responsibility, that's simply unfair.
You abused your time, Mr. Collins. Thank you. The appellee has not filed a brief. The case is submitted, and you will be advised of our opinion.